The Money Show. Business Unusual with Colin Cullis.
Colin Cullis tonight with Business Unusual. The world's rich seem to have nothing better to do than write letters, but not to each other, but letters to humanity, letters, open letters to the world. Warren Buffett does an annual shareholder letter, which anybody can access, and it's always fascinating and interesting, sometimes funny, always warm and charming. And Bill and Melinda Gates, Bill and Warren are besties. Bill started doing the same. What Warren does is good for Bill, and what Bill does is good for Warren. They also, Bill and Melinda, but it's a different kind of letter, I guess. It's not about how to invest and become super rich or what's going to catch you out next time on investments. It's all about doing good things in the world.
Yes, from the world's largest foundation, thanks to, in part, Warren Buffett, who gave most of his fortune in Berkshire Hathaway to the foundation. So between Bill and Melinda, Bill Gates, founder and owner of sort of big person in Microsoft, and Melinda Gates, who we met while working there and obviously played a very big role as a couple going through that whole thing, founded the foundation back in the early 90s to deal with lots of people who were simply approaching Microsoft to say, hey, could you help with this, could you help with that, and him looking to, when he quit sort of back in early 2005, sort of there, he was looking to take on something else, and he'd started to become very interested in, he'd seen what technology, software could do for solving problems in the business world, and wondered if technology and the things he'd learned there might be able to help in the real world. Well, real world is the wrong way to describe it, but with other very real world problems that weren't looking specifically at business. And so started getting involved. And 2006, as I say, Warren Buffett said, look, I'm looking to make my money do something for when I'm not here. And you guys seem to have a path to doing that. Here is a lot of money, and right now they're sitting at $50 billion as assets, and then they use approximately 5% a year that they use for investments while still trying to grow that as fast and as big as possible, with a caveat that when they die, the money must be dispersed within 20 years of their deaths. So it's not meant to be the sort of great way to avoid estate tax and those other clever things that some billionaires might say, hoo-hoo, this foundation thing, that sounds a very clever way for us to keep a lovely legacy and everybody will remember us as being wonderful people. But the point of the letter is that every year they look at things that they've been looking to address. They haven't necessarily changed what they want to do. But by writing the letter every year, they can reflect as to what movement has there been, what improvements have there been, or what did they get wrong. And they acknowledge that Warren Buffett actually does humor better, but that they really took a thing out of his book for saying, you should be honest with shareholders, in this case, the world, about what you're trying to do and how well you manage to do it. And this is kind of where the Business Unusual bit comes in, because often there's a little bit of a, let's make it look good, you know, make the annual reports look impressive and hide all the nasty stuff away. It's not to say that everybody agrees with everything they say, but at least there's a little more candor coming from them. So there are 9 points that they've got in this one. It's the 11th, that's now a decade that they've been writing these, and all of them are published online, so you can go and read the first letter. I went in and read all the letters, and you do get a real sense about how things are improving. And they do get asked, you know, can you remain optimistic with all the challenges in the world or whatever else? And reading these letters, when they set an ambitious task sort of 2007, 2008, and then you read a couple of years later how things, for example, child mortality was a big one, that they're actually starting to see those numbers come down. They're not massive things they need to do. It's pretty much just supplying vaccines, making sure that basic nutrition, etc., is provided. But it's complex, because getting the vaccines to the right places, working with local communities, governments, whatever else, to say, well, why do I need this and how do you deploy it, and all of those sorts of challenges, those are the things they're overcoming. It's not like, have we got a vaccine? For very many of these cases, there is a solution. They're entirely preventable deaths. And then what they see is when you start seeing the drop-off in the mortalities, a whole different set of positive things can come from it. And their first one is to acknowledge that Africa is now the youngest continent in the world, the median age being 18, South Africa not far off at 27. But that is both an opportunity and a bit of a challenge. Having such a large population of young people says, wow, we're fantastically positioned to be able to have lots of enthusiastic, yes, we can change the world people, applying themselves to whatever the challenges are that are coming. But it requires them to have opportunities, certainly by way of education, and nutrition. And the issue that they're looking to tackle is that educational challenge and the nutrition challenge. And ultimately, that governments in Africa, like most elsewhere in the world as well, they're not necessarily the youngest lot who's sitting in government. And so their view of the world tends to be from their own understanding. And this lot has pretty much looked at how that very rarely remains that way. There's lots of disruption. There's lots of challenges. What you used to do 10, 15, 20 years ago is not the way you're going to do it for the next 10 or 15 years. And so I don't know how they're going to do this. This is what we'll find out in 10 years' time. But if those governments are capable of saying, let's harness the fact that we have this young, very exuberant population, as does South Africa, create the opportunities, so focus on creating opportunities for them, then that little bubble effectively can both better look after the aging generation through their own productivity, economic activities, but also this understanding that when child mortality comes down, so does birth rates. There isn't a feeling that I have a child because my child might not survive to 10, whatever else. So you almost think I need to have multiple children. And it seems counterintuitive that having more children will lead to having less children, because by having more children, they're not necessarily that there are more children, they're fewer than there are dying in child in their child age. And a lot of people sort of struggle with that. So that's one big one they've been working with, and it's succeeding. 10 million deaths a year when they started. It's now coming up to about half that, and they're looking to get less than 1 million deaths globally from unnecessary, you know, child mortalities. So that's a big plus that they can already say that that's doing quite well. The next one is that toilets are actually terrible technology. I mean, their point is, when it was created, wow, it was like game-changing technology for the world. But water was cheap and prevalent, and there weren't that many of us. And as cities are rapidly expanding and growing, we simply can't build that kind of infrastructure using that precious resource, that scarce resource, in the same way. We need
Bill Gates' obsession with toilets is on one level hilarious.
Yes.
And on the other level, it is terrifying, because he's seeing a future where public health issues are dominant and prominent.
Yeah, so it's not just an impact. You know, the first thing is providing toilets and all of the health implications from not having toilets. And this could be somebody that just doesn't feel safe to go wherever communal toilet is, and so doesn't go and has, you know, urinary problems because they just kept it in, through to having unsanitary toilets very close to a home or water sources, and kind of creating problems as a consequence of that everywhere where it goes. So Cape Town currently is hosting a significant conference looking at water management and sanitation.
What's it called?
The FSM5.
FSM5. Yes. What does it stand for?
The Fecal Sludge Management Conference.
The Fecal Sludge Management Conference. There's a conference for fecal sludge management.
An in-depth, big discussions on exactly what, how best to manage fecal sludge, which is, I think,
I mean, one looks at the pollution in the Vaal River Basin, for example. I mean, that stuff is absolutely critical, because our entire water system is under threat as a result of fecal sludge. So, good one. What did one of the delegates call a bus trip they took a water treatment plant?
So the city put on a tour to go and show them the sanitation works here in the city, and he hashtagged that in one of his tweets as feco-tourism, which is quite novel. I don't think many people are going to be joining that bandwagon, though. The next one they have, and you kind of think, well, hasn't this happened already? Because there are now more mobile phones, more people have mobile phones that don't have mobile phones. But there's a disparity between, certainly in gender, for who has that here in this continent. And so their next thing is to say, if we want to see continued great impact from mobile phones, women must get them. Because the exact same socioeconomic opportunities that are provided for men, for finding work, for getting access to information, you know, all of these sort of things, is not yet currently available for women. And when they also get that access, we'll see the double benefit from that one. And then there's one on the climate change, which obviously that's the elephant in the room. You can do what you want, but if we're not going to sort out the climate, all of this is kind of for naught. And they point to, of course, you know, fossil fuel energy generation is a problem, as is agriculture. But the third one is manufacturing, and a big chunk of that manufacturing goes into building. When we cast cement, when we need to build cities, they create a lot of carbon dioxide, and we need to build a lot of cities. And they described the whole thing as things that they were surprised by. And they're saying that the world between now and 2060 is effectively going to be building something the size of New York every year. It's going to double the total number of buildings on the planet from now to 2060 in 40 years that we have spent the last whole time that humans have been on the planet building. That's how much more development is going to be as we move to cities. And that's a real challenge that I certainly haven't heard too many people talking about. How are we going to make cement less, you know, carbon neutral, make it more carbon neutral?
Today in the budget, Tito Boweni talking about residential developments in South Africa. We've got to stop going for one level and spreading outwards. We will run out of space. We've got to be thinking about high density, affordable housing. For example, it was one of the issues that did come through in South Africa's budget today.
So it is a massive one. And, you know, they've got nine of them. Those are the ones that are principally affecting Africa. There was one that actually this week came out that was pretty good. They wanted to get rid of malaria. So that's a parasite in a specific kind of mosquito that is very prevalent here in Africa. You know, hundreds of millions of infections every year and hundreds of thousands of deaths.
The deadliest animal on the continent, yes.
Quite right. And a trial that they've been sort of supporting went into the next phase. They gene edited the mosquito, the specific species that does carry the malaria parasite, in a way that when these mosquitoes breed with other mosquitoes, they will all effectively become males. So the female is the one that bites humans, and that's where the parasite gets transformed. But by becoming males, of course, that's the end of the line. That mosquito genetic line ends there. So it's a very clever way of saying, here's how we can ensure that they won't survive. But the other thing that was quite clever, because they used this CRISPR thing. I don't even remember the mind-bending conversation we had about how we edit genes these days with clever little molecules. But they effectively edited this gene so that usually you have a gene and it gets half the population will get, half won't. That's the diversity. These genes, all of the offspring get it. So they can effectively reduce those numbers very rapidly. Hopefully then not enough parasites can get into the surviving mosquitoes. That parasite effectively dies out. The mosquitoes might still survive, but at least the burden goes. And so they cover these and all of the other ones in great detail. They really are kind of eye-opening. And given the amount of money they have, you would think it should get others to sort of join in, so that the enormous wealth that they've managed to generate from software, that the software has already changed the world in one respect, perhaps now the wealth from it can change it again.
It's a wonderful story. Thank you, Colin Cullis, with Business Unusual on a Wednesday night.